This is the BC Resource Group's Path to Partner podcast, where we get exclusive insights from the leading figures in legal. And now, here's your host, Colin Moses.
Hello and welcome to BC Resource Group's Path to Partner podcast, where we interview some of the industry leaders in legal and find out how they climbed the corporate ladder and what tidbits of advice they have for our candidates that are looking to do the same thing. So today we are fortunate enough to have Ronald Scheckman, who is the managing partner and chair of the Labour and Employment Group at Prior Cashman. Now, Ron's been managing partner since 2007. The first non-founding partner to have that title, and was named a distinguished leader by the New York Law Journal for his successful management of Prior Cashman. So, Ron, thank you so much for joining us today.
Colin, it's a pleasure.
Awesome. So, Ron, could you tell me a little bit about your firm? Like, I know it's a mid-sized firm, but could you tell me a little bit about it and what you guys specialize in?
Well, we think of ourselves as the mid-sized firm that can. We have grown to about 170 lawyers. It's a general practice firm with a strong emphasis in litigation, corporate and real estate transactional work, including practices in family law, immigration, labor and employment, tax, private equity, estate planning, private client, full service.
Okay, so you guys cover the gauntlet then.
Indeed.
Awesome. So, Ron, a little bit about you. What made you want to become a lawyer in the first place?
Well, when I was going to college, I wasn't sure what to do, and law school seemed like a good way to avoid making that decision, frankly. So I went to law school. School seemed a better alternative than working, and it was also the height of the Vietnam War. So indeed, school seemed like a good option.
Well, that sounds like the same exact reason I went to business school. Just delay in the inevitable as long as possible.
That's right.
Awesome.
But to my surprise, I found that I actually liked law school and was excited by the prospect of applying learning and going into the world and making a difference. That these were the early 70s. It was a time when people believed that we could change the world, we would change the world. And many of us were trying to change the world. So that law school was an exciting time. The country was dealing with Vietnam and Richard Nixon, and a lot was happening. So it led me into civil liberties, civil rights, and labor and employment practice, a small practice that I thought was exciting and a great opportunity.
So would you say that the times that you came up in directly influenced the type of law you decided to practice?
No question. I was fortunate to have done well at law school, and I had many options before me. I decided that I did not want to go into big law, the so-called Wall Street practice at the time,
right,
and wanted an alternative. I didn't want to do a clerkship. I didn't want anything more to do with academics. As I said, I wanted to go out and change the world and somehow influence someone's life. So I chose a small practice, as I said, with someone who had a very exciting platform at the time in a civil rights, civil liberties, and labor practice.
Okay. So what were your early years, those early years like, and compared to how your years?
First and foremost, they were exciting to. After 4 years of college and 3 years of law school, I was itching to have something to do with the real world, if you will. And right off, I did, and had enormous opportunities to work with a number of unions of professional employees that were then forming and growing. And because of the nature of a very small firm at the time that I had joined, I came into great responsibilities and a very exciting initiation into the practice of law. One that, you know, took me to gave me the opportunity to argue a case before the U.S. Supreme Court when I was, 29 or 30 years old.
Oh, that must have been a great experience.
Indeed.
Awesome. How did you end up at Pryor Cashman?
Well, as so often happens, that the small firm I worked with and the senior partner there was a mentor to me. And the firm, after a few years, the name changed to Gordon and Scheckman. And my name was up there. And I was developing my client relationships. I was developing a bit of a book of business. And as is the case often in life, the relationships between a senior mentor and a junior mentee right. get very, very complicated. And indeed, that relationship became complicated. And I looked for an alternative, and it became time to move. I had developed a good deal of what was then considered a good deal of business, and I was about 33 years old, and I heard about what was then a mid-sized firm of 35 lawyers called Pryor Cashman that had no labor and employment practice. So I met with Gideon Cashman, and it sounded exciting. And I also had some connection to the entertainment business. And Pryor Cashman then had a very large entertainment practice, and that was also attractive. So I came into Pryor Cashman in 1985 to lead its labor and employment practice.
Okay, and then you built that from the ground up.
Indeed, we did.
Okay, so and how many lawyers do you have in that practice now?
We have about five lawyers who are exclusively dedicated to labor and employment and various aspects of it.
Awesome. Now, Ron, I know that as a managing partner that, you know, it's gets very stressful. And I know a lot of the candidates that we speak to, one of the main things that they ask is to go in-house because they get a better work-life balance. How do you deal with the work-life balance challenge?
Well, I think everyone deals with that in a different way. So I'm going to try to avoid generalizing about that. You know, I have partners here, including some of our senior partners, who have struck the life balance equation very much in favor of work over life, if there is that fair distinction. And I have others who struggle to balance it the other way. And I think one of the advantages of this firm is that we are able to deal with significant variations in how people do that balancing.
Right. So does that, and so I guess with the people that want more of a life as opposed to work in their work-life balance, would they be working from home more, or like how does that generally work for them?
I think, you know, among the older partners, I think they are used to working in the office. I think those who work at home electronically for the most part tend to be the younger generation of lawyers here. But the work-life balance really is, as we deal with it for partners, is a function of the nature of their business. And it also has to do with the computation of their compensation, so that, you know, we balance it as well as along with the individual.
Okay, great. So what specific challenges do you think were unique to your experience as you made the transition to Pryor Cashman and managing partner?
Which transition are you referring to?
To managing partner at Pryor Cashman.
Or just
challenges in general throughout your career. Like, was there anything that you feel like was unique to you?
I think part of the challenge was transitioning from the idealism of a young lawyer who is going to change the world into a lawyer who is going to run a quite significant mid-size firm and manage relatively large and complex business.
Right. Well, I mean, well, there's many ways you can change the world. I mean, you can change the world on a grand scale and a macro scale, but I'm sure, you know, with what you're doing, you're changing the world of the people that you represent. And, you know, so there's different ways to change the world. So I don't know, do you see it that way? Do you feel like you have achieved the change in the world that you set out to do? Or do you feel like you've changed direction?
I think you've put your hand on something very significant. I feel an enormous responsibility to the 200 some odd employees here, including the partners and their families and extended families, who all in some ways are dependent on the success and growth of this firm. So I consider that a great responsibility. How well I do it, how well the other leadership in this firm do their jobs, has an enormous impact on a lot of people, from everybody who works in our mailroom to every partner in this firm.
Awesome. So what were some of the early leadership lessons that you learned?
Prior Cashman is a fairly unique firm in the entrepreneurial tradition we have here. This is a firm where almost 40% of the partners originate $1 million or more in business. 60% of the partners originate $500,000 or more. Our associates are encouraged, and many of them are active in developing a client base. And this has grown out of a culture that gives lawyers an enormous amount of discretion and freedom and independence, if you will, to develop business and to not only be top-rate professionals, but also to be good business people, which is also required in developing and growing the practice of law. So that the tradition that Gideon Cashman, the founder of this firm, really created was a laissez-faire environment that gives attorneys the kind of freedom and discretion that has very much led to our success, with a broad base of originators and a large client base that has given this firm a great deal of security that some mid-sized firms do not have.
Right. Now, you mentioned that, like, how much business that the partners are bringing in and some of the associates. Now, well, let me ask you, how did you first start building your client relationships and building your business? And how do you encourage the associates and the other partners at the firm to do the same thing?
I wish I could tell you that I fully understood the ingredients that lead people to develop business while others can go through much of their career developing no business. So it is a combination of many different qualities, starting with the ability to ask people for business. But for me, I know my drive as a young lawyer was to try to take any matter I worked on and make it my own, if you will, to take as much responsibility as I could, to work directly with the clients, and to create relationships with the clients where they would trust me and rely on me and ultimately look to me for leadership. So that, you know, I started working with a number of different employee associations and unions and created relationships that ultimately led those clients to look to me as their primary attorney. And it was certainly my drive to take the lead, if you will, in managing cases and managing clients and managing relationships. But I think everyone, right, you know, approaches business development in different ways. This is a firm, you know, we have a great group in our marketing department that really helps young lawyers think about how they do the same, how they create relationships or develop relationships that can lead to or foster business and reliance on that lawyer for advice and assistance in legal matters.
Okay, so you guys have a specific department that helps lawyers in the business development and, you know, gives them guidance on, you know, different steps that they should take.
We certainly keep in the consciousness of our lawyers the idea and thinking about how you develop contacts and business in terms of business development for the law firm.
Awesome. So, Ryan, how would you describe your leadership style?
It's a good question and a tough question. I think it's one that relies on my partners, or relies on my confidence in my partners, to be sound business people and to be responsible professionals in how they do their business and how they manage their business. I try not to manage down. I try to rely on department leaders and others in the firm working most directly with the attorneys, and to give them the support and guidance when and if appropriate in how to develop our talent, how to develop our client base, and of course, most importantly, how to deliver effective and efficient legal services.
Right. Now, you spoke about developing talent. How do you do that?
We are a law firm that is benefiting from the phenomena of millennials. Millennials, I think, are
right.
You know, the millennials are subject to a lot of criticism about how much they want to work and whether they'll stay in a job for long and what kind of commitment they'll make.
Right.
While we're finding the concern and interest among millennials to find a workplace that is rewarding and makes them feel valued and makes them feel meaningfully engaged, to be to our benefit, that right. The kind of responsibility that a young attorney can get at a firm of our size, you know, in a mid-sized market, working in without a lot of leverage. So we see the case of young lawyers who are working in big law, where they'll spend a couple of years on discovery tasks for large complex litigation, and then come here and be fully engaged in a number of different matters where they'll be participating quite quickly in depositions, court appearances, client contact, you know, working in a team of two or three lawyers and not 20 or 30 lawyers, which is the former being the nature of our practice. I tell this anecdote of a young partner who came here a few years ago, a young associate who came here a few years ago from a very large law firm. And he had been there for 4.5 years, and he had been at Prior Cashman for 4.5 months. I saw him in the hallway and I said, "What's the difference in being at Prior Cashman from your prior experience at the larger firm?" And he said that in 4.5 months, he had already worked on more matters than he had in 4.5 years at his prior law firm. So, and I think that's a common experience. We're getting lawyers with top credentials coming from large firms after they've gone into judicial clerkships and choosing to come here rather than go back to their other firms because of the kind of responsibilities they're able to assume and the kind of gratification that comes from getting those responsibilities sooner and working more closely in a smaller team so that their work is more reflected in the mission of the case and in the results we reach.
Okay, so would you say that the difference between your firm and, say, you know, one of the larger big law firms is that there's more interpersonal relationships and there's more range of tasks that you get to work on, and, you know, there's a bigger range of things that you get to do as opposed to the larger firms?
I think that's a fair statement. At our summer outing last year, I saw a young associate on a tennis court who had just joined our firm a few months earlier, and she came from a Am Law 20 firm. And I said, "How are you doing here?" She's a litigator. And with excitement, she said, "It's been fantastic. I've been to court. I've finished a complaint. I'm going to a deposition later this week. And she was just animated with the diversity of her work and the interface with the clients and the courts and the kind of responsibilities that young lawyers here arrive at probably at an earlier time than they do in most large firms.
Well, that's awesome because that's what keeps people happy. You know, they want to be engaged and they want to enjoy their job. So that's great that the younger lawyers at the firm are experiencing that.
You know, it goes back to what I said about I wanted to get out of law school, and I think a lot of people feel this, and have some real impact to get away from a lot of academic study and to finally go out in the real world and to see that the fruits of your labor actually affect someone or change something.
Right, right. So, Rona, has there been any lessons from your early management experiences?
Well, I've learned that as a managing partner, I only maintain a pretense that I'm able to influence the conduct of my partners. That's the first lesson that, and some of my partners don't really understand that when they say, you have to tell so-and-so this is what they have to do, or you have to stop someone from doing X or tell someone to do Y. And that doesn't really work in a law firm like Prior Cashman, at least, and probably not in many law firms where lawyers who have risen to the position of partner and have that kind of seniority and status, if you will, that they've presumably earned, that they're not easily herded. As I say that, you know, I spend a lot of my time herding cats, you know, or getting butterflies to fly in formation. It doesn't happen naturally or easily. And it really only happens if your partners really trust your judgment and look to your leadership to take us all to a better place, if you will, in terms of our business and development and growth.
Right, right. So turning towards your career path and how you made it to partner, what do you think helped you most? And is there anything that you would have perhaps done differently that might have advanced your career quicker?
You know, the path to partner was really a product of what I talked about previously, right. And that was my drive and interest and in taking a leadership role in the client relationship and in handling cases and proceedings and matters for clients, friends, and others. I was, you know, always eager when I met people to see how my professional talents could in some way be complementary to what their needs are or would be, and put me in a fortunate position to develop business. So, you know, that's what got me, mm-hmm. if you will, on the road to partnership, on the road to firm leadership. I don't think there's a map for that. I think it is really a function of the interplay between a lawyer and his or her partners and how a lawyer is perceived and what leadership skills they have and what success they have and as professionals and as business developers.
Awesome. We're winding down now, Ron. I wanted to ask you, though, when it comes to people that you're hiring, what do you look for when you're making bets on the people that come into that are interviewing at Prior Cashman, and or what character traits, what are things that you specifically see and say, okay, yes, this is someone I'd like to have, or you see something you see and you say, oh, we don't want that here.
You know, one of the differences between a mid-sized firm and big law that has offices around the country and often around the world is that the partners here know every right. other partner. And there is a very strong sense of community. And it's very important for the culture of a mid-sized firm like ours, and certainly in our case, that the people whom we bring in laterally and the people whom we promote are people who can participate in this community in a collaborative and partnership way, partner way, that they work well with others and that they will assist other partners and see that as a two-way street. So that, you know, one of the things I'm proudest about in our firm is that no matter how busy one partner may be, she will put down what she's doing to help another partner pitch a matter or develop that business, knowing that it's a two-way street and that partner will be coming down her way looking for that help, you know, another day.
Okay. Now, do you find that there's an adjustment period for people that come from the larger law firms, cultural-wise, when it comes to like the whole collaborative nature that you just spoke about?
Indeed, I do. I knock on wood as I say this, but we have barely any attrition out of this firm at the partner level, really at any level, but especially at the partner level, that our lateral recruitment often involves partners coming from big law who are looking for an entrepreneurial platform, one that affords them hourly rates and opportunities in business development that it's much harder to do at some larger firms. So that indeed, that's the response we get from those attorneys is that we have succeeded in giving them that platform. And as I said before, that collaborative environment where the partner next to them or down the hall is going to help them when they need help developing business because they're going to be there to help that partner when, you know, he or she needs it.
Great. What is your industry outlook for the next few years, both in regards to just legal in general and in regards to labor and employment?
Well, generally, the legal analysts and economists have been reporting for many years flat demand. And this really goes back to 2008 and 2009, to the Great Recession. We're finding the opposite to be true, that since the Great Recession, we have had steady growth and very dramatic increases in demand for services among our attorneys. I think we have grown the firm by probably 50% in that period, and most of it's been organic. I think what's happened is that the legal market that where there is, while there's little growth in demand, there's increasing demand for efficient economic services, that value-driven market has grown. So as clients are increasingly demanding and in search of firms that can deliver services leanly, efficiently, and economically, gives a firm in our position and has given this firm great opportunity to grow our business. We, you know, have a leaner cost model. We don't have a lot of different offices to feed. We operate, with great sensitivity to our costs, and it allows us to have a different rate structure than most of big law and to compete for business where we can greater value for the services we're providing.
So would you say that as a result of the recession that I guess clients were a little bit more weary of where and how they were spending their money and that led to the growth that you've experienced?
Yes. Yes, I do think that's the case. I also believe that traditionally a lot of clients, particularly clients of big law, consolidated all of their work in one, two, or three firms that had particular specialties that would encompass most of their work. I think what's happened since the Great Recession is that many of those clients have recognized that they can get high quality professional service from different firms outside of big law, where they can get the same kind of highly professional, highly competent work at a very different price point and with a very different management style. The advantage, some of the advantages being that the partner they come to or the partner assigned their case is going to be the partner who owns that case. And that partner is going to walk into the deposition or to the transaction with a much smaller team than he or she might have in another context.
I wanted to know what percentage of partners, lateral partners coming from other firms, would you say have success in making the transition to Pryor Cashman?
I'm especially proud of our results in that respect. It seems to be a bit like baseball, the statistics I've seen, where if you're batting over 300, you're considered to be quite successful. There are stars out there that supposedly bat around 500. And I would say that our success has been over 800. And I'm especially proud that we've found that the laterals have not only met our expectations, but and their own expectations, but have generally exceeded them. I think it is because we have primarily looked at lawyers who have felt siloed and frustrated by their positions at big law, where they have not been encouraged to develop business, in some cases even discouraged from bringing in business, that a rate structure that has associates billing at $800 or $900 an hour, we're not far away from the $1,000 an hour associate in big law, that have found that our platform affords them the kind of flexibility, the economics that allow them to go to clients and attract business and have a wide base of practices, a full service firm behind them to market and develop and to build practices. So that, as I said, in almost all cases, our laterals have succeeded so as to surpass our expectations and their own expectations.
Awesome stuff. What is the governance structure and the compensation model at Pryor Cashman?
We have an executive committee of seven lawyers, which I lead, and we have a compensation committee that consists of three lawyers from the executive committee and three lawyers who rotate through the comp committee from different practice areas in the firm. And we address compensation as we address most issues here, with flexibility, with adaptability. And when people say, what are the standards and what are the metrics? I say that we treat partner compensation by treating each partner as a snowflake, that each is unique. To say as flake, by the way, but a snowflake, that that each one has unique characteristics. And because we know each part, we are able to measure his or her performance and role in the firm and the nature and quality of their service or business.
Cool. So what three or four tips would you give to new college grads, as well as those that would like to transfer laterally into Pryor Cashman?
Well, when I look at laterals, it's a matter of really two kinds of searches. One will be to look for particular expertise and where we need to fill a gap or add a competence. And there it's a function of finding someone with that competence, with that training and experience. Generally, we find that even in the cases where we're looking for service partners, the nature of the culture here and the support for business development even leads those partners who we bring in a service capacity to morph into originating partners as well. It's a great problem to manage. But generally and more frequently, we're looking for, you know, we're opportunistic in our lateral search, looking for lawyers who have what it takes and a history in business development or a promise in their future because of what they've done in the past that makes us believe that they have the personal qualities and professional qualities to develop the business we're talking about.
Now, do the laterals, do they have to come in with their own clients, their own client base? Because I know, like, obviously there's a lot of non-compete clauses and things of that nature. So how do you get around that? Or do the laterals just come in and are they able to start again building from, well, not scratch because they do have prior relationships, but, you know, start building their business again?
There are no restrictive covenants that are binding on lawyers, that law firms are ethically prohibited from precluding a lawyer directly or indirectly from going on and continuing his or her practice. The nature of legal ethics is that a law firm can do nothing that would take away the freedom of a client to choose a lawyer. So, yeah.
Oh, really? Okay, I didn't know that because I've had quite a few candidates have said to me, you know, I can't really bring any clients to my new position because of the agreement that I signed with my previous firm. So I didn't know that that agreement was pretty much not really worth
not worth the paper it's written on or the ink with which it's written. I can tell you, it has never been my experience to ever meet a lawyer from the firms we've talked to, or lawyers from firms with which we've been engaged, who have ever had such a restrictive covenant. Some firms try to make access to their capital, to partners' capital accounts difficult, and try to inhibit partners moving on that basis. But they can't link any inhibition or restraint on a lawyer's ability to move from one firm to another with his or her clients or to appeal to any clients of the other firm. That the legal profession, and this is true, I believe, in 50 states, that the legal profession is not permitted to take away the client's choice of attorney. There's been a recent number of bankruptcy cases where the law previously was in the bankruptcy realm that when a law firm went bankrupt and a lawyer went to a new firm and took an hourly rated matter, that the bankrupt estate had some interest in the future fees that would be generated there. The most recent court decisions now at the highest level, at the federal circuit courts and in the New York Court of Appeals, have all repudiated that doctrine, saying that when a firm goes bankrupt, a lawyer leaves and takes whatever business he or she has, and that the bankrupt estate has no claim on that business if it's typically hourly rated. And that's consistent with the strain in law that no lawyers can be restrained from maintaining the client relationships to the extent that the client wants that lawyer.
Oh, interesting. That's good to know. Very good to know.
Yes. You tell those lawyers who bring those agreements to you that, you know, that no judge is going to countenance them or otherwise give them any credibility whatsoever.
Awesome. That's good. Yeah, that's great to know. And what about for college grads, new college grads, just finishing law school? What would you say to them if they wanted to find their way as an associate in Prior Cashman?
To make themselves indispensable, to make the partner with whom they're working feel that they need that associate on that case. And even more importantly, if they have the opportunity to make the client feel that associate is indispensable. And that comes from demonstrating to the partner and or the client that you are completely dedicated, you are knowledgeable, that you are driven to further their interest to the maximum extent possible, so that they see you as a important part, an essential part of the team that will hopefully deliver the desired result for them.
That's great. So, Ron, how do you interview and hire at Pryor Cashman?
I generally screen partner laterals. It starts with me because I think I can best describe the nature and culture of our firm, that I have an understanding of our needs in terms of the talent or business that the individual needs. So then I introduce a lateral who has merit to the department in which she or he would work, and steer them through a process where they get to know whom they'd be working with, the nature of the work they'd be doing, and the culture of the practice in which they're interested. From there, if everyone remains on the same page and interested in each other, I bring in the leadership of the firm, the executive committee, ultimately to meet with and make a judgment as to whether we think that person can be additive and productive and positive as an addition to the firm.
Okay, so what's the general time frame from initial interest until hire, and how many interviews and meetings go on in that space of time?
Well, I sometimes consider my primary role here at Pryor Cashman is the rushing chairman, so that I spend an enormous amount of my time meeting candidates and making decisions about whom to bring into a more extensive process and others where there's not an appropriate fit, so that we get an enormous number of inquiries from recruiting agencies and firms, and sometimes from lawyers directly or sometimes through other partners here, so that there is a pretty steady stream of lateral candidates with whom I'm meeting and whom we're considering. So it is very much an ongoing process. And I think it's an essential and important process to a firm, because it's also a process that keeps us getting younger, which is an important part for any law firm, and particularly mid-sized firms, which are less institutional than much of big law. So that, you know, mid-sized firms can get in trouble when they become a group of older partners who are carrying on their backs most of the business of the firm, and who at certain points grow weary and decide the only way to deal with that weariness is a merger. That's not our aspiration. We want to maintain who we are and the culture that we have. And accordingly, to keep that fresh and to keep it growing requires to grow organically our own partners into the partnership, as well as to add, where appropriate and where opportunistic, laterals who will help us grow and remain vital.
Okay. So say, for instance, the last partner that you hired, from the first meeting with you or with anybody at the firm to when they actually got hired, what was that time span?
Well, we just finished a process that took, I would say, about 2 to 3 months. In other cases, I've done it in 2 to 3 weeks. In other cases, I've done it in 2 to 3 years.
Okay. So
there's no simple answer. There's no right or wrong answer to that question. It really depends on the nature of the candidate, mm-hmm. how eager or ready they are to move or not to move, how extensive a search the candidate himself or herself wants to conduct. You know, one of the things about our process, or one aspect of our process that I think that has contributed to its success, is our agility and our ability to move quickly and to do our due diligence effectively and promptly, so that we can act with alacrity. But often some of the candidates whom we meet, including candidates who will join us, are not inclined to act with alacrity. You know, they start the process, they're unsure, they wait a while, they wait for their bonus at their old firm, whatever it may be, that there are so many variations on the process that I'm reluctant to generalize.
Right. Okay. Now, when you're going through the, you said you're mainly involved with the hiring of lateral partners. Do you deal with associates at all, or is that left to others at the firm?
No, I don't generally.
Okay. What are your best interview questions for the partners that you interview?
My best interview question is, what questions do you have about prior Cashman?
And then from their response, that will tell you everything.
That response, I will tell you, will tell me more than anything else.
Right.
There are many candidates who come here. I'm not sure many of these proceed in the process, who say they have no questions. And, you know, they looked at our website. That's often a tell to me about their inclination as well as their curiosity and as well as their drive to make the right decision.
So what would be like a good response that you've heard to that question?
A good response would be some interesting, provocative questions that require me to give them, I hope, meaningful insight about our firm, and particularly as to whatever their practice may be or whatever their needs may be or whatever their concerns may be.
Right. So it's just really just showing an interest more so than anything else, and showing a bit of initiative that, you know, you actually are interested in the firm. You're not just looking for another job, and you are interested in, you know, how you'll fit there and things that you cannot just find out by simply browsing the website.
You want someone who's discerning. You want someone who's curious. You want someone who, in making an important decision, is going to conduct a thorough and meaningful investigation. If they don't, I think it probably reflects on how they might do legal work as well.
Yeah, totally. Totally. All right. Well, thank you, Ron. The last question is there anything exciting that you can discuss that the firm is working on?
We have been particularly busy in the last year and a half, and it's continuing now with another proceeding in an area that's been quite fascinating. And it's also one where I say it's been a matter of us, the David, against the Goliaths, where we represent the Music Publishers Association, a national organization that represents Sony, EMI, Warner Music, Universal, and others.
Right.
And the process for setting rates by which they are, the music publishers and the music authors, are compensated for music that is played is done through an arbitration process conducted at the National Library and in Washington. And we, in representing music publishers, have been involved in a proceeding that is still continuing, setting the rates for music streaming. So we became involved in that proceeding where we were litigating against Google, Apple Music, Spotify, Pandora, Amazon Prime, all of which are the major streaming services, and their law firms from the Am Law 50. And we have been involved in these proceedings over the last couple of years. It's been intense. It's been exciting, and so far quite successful. So that's been a very exciting part of our litigation practice that has involved a team of probably 10 or 12 lawyers.
Awesome. Well, Ronald, it's been great having you on the podcast. Thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it. And thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to the Path to Partner podcast. For more exclusive content, log on to bcresourcegroup.com or subscribe to the show on iTunes.